You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and served numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey guys, welcome to the Worldwide Will Show. I'm joined by
Matt.
Thank you for coming, Matt. Really appreciate it. So in this show, we're talking about veterans' lives, where it's taken them and where they're at now. So Matt, started in Somerset, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, Taunton, Somerset. Not much to do. I mean, the only thing really you can say about the town is they got 40 commando there.
Yeah.
And that's basically it.
Ruins the town.
I wouldn't say it ruins it, but
changes
the
it.
Bars like it, I'll tell
you
that.
Yeah, I bet they do. So were you a lonely child or siblings?
No, I had two sisters and a brother, and I was, middle child syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an older sister, a younger sister, and a younger brother. So my younger brother was born extremely premature, so
yeah.
he had the record for 12 years for the most premature baby born in French Aid Hospital in Bristol.
Oh, wow.
So he was born 4 months premature in 91. Bloody so a lot of difficulties with my brother growing up. So prior to that, we lived in a caravan, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, because my brother, we then got council housing, etc., yep. And then moved from a small town, Minehead, to Taunton, where my mother was a nurse. So that was that was my childhood, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So did you always want to join the army throughout your teenage years, or was it just
No. No. I mean, I was 15, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, I wanted to just play computer games, etc., etc. And the only thing I was really good at school was sciences and maths, and I've liked those because you're right or you're wrong. There's no interpretation. There's none of this reading between the lines. So I liked science and maths, and it was just a natural ability of mine. So I did pretty good in my GCSEs, my science higher paper. I only lost points for spelling, and it was mm-hmm. just a bit too easy, actually. So I was thinking, beyond school, what do? I applied for local college to do maths, higher maths, physics, and chemistry, because my idea was to go on to engineering at university. But then a guy I was working with, at the time I was working in a chip shop, and this guy just, I think he was doing a law degree.
Yeah.
Couldn't get a job after his degree, and he worked in a chip shop, and there I was like 15 years old next to a guy with a degree in law, and I thought, well, do I really want to do all that with no guarantee of a job at the end of it?
Sure.
He's in a lot of debt, and I'm worse of money than him, so I'll be even more debt. Do I really want to do that? So as I was finishing school, it was, I don't really know what to do, and there was a lad in my town. I mean, I wouldn't call him a friend. I've met him like once or twice, but I knew his name. On his 18th birthday, he went out drinking. And on his way home, he got killed. And I was frustrated because they were all under a certain age. When it came to actual
trial
and sentencing, between the four people that attacked him, they were given no more than 5 years locked up. And at the time, there was a TV show you probably remember called Bad Lads Army.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like how prison should be, rather than, you have your own room, your Xbox, your TV, and it's just a holiday camp.
Yeah.
And I said, you should chuck him in a military prison because that's how it should be. And that's when my mother mentioned it. And to be fair, I thought, I'm not really that interested, but I'll look into it just because it'll keep her quiet, and at least I've then got another option. And the more I looked into it, the more appealing it became.
Yeah.
And at that time I wasn't overly very fit, so it was a case of, well, I don't want to do that. That sounds a bit dangerous. I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went down to Duchy College in Cornwall, and I was very fortunate. The course leader, he was a colour sergeant in Devon and Dorset Infantry.
Yeah.
He happened to live literally just up the road to me. And he would drive me from Taunton about 120 odd miles every morning down to Cornwall, where he runs this college course.
Yeah.
So everyone's literally just finished school, so they're like 16, 17. And it's basically like army cadets, but
is it like army preparation?
It's an army prep course,
yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's like army cadets. Just it is just all day, every day, and it's a bit more hard. A bit more than that, yeah. So you learn about the military, and we went on a firepower demo to Warminster, which is the first year they showed the Apache.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, this whole fighting thing seems pretty cool. So then I decided I'm going to join the infantry.
Yeah.
Then I actually got talked out of it. And just before I went to recruit selection, I changed my option to engineers about a month before I went to selection, because they actually got my GCSE results. And I was like, well, you're not stupid, so you can do this. And I'd just been accepted to the local sixth form college as well. And obviously, I didn't even turn up for that. I then joined the army. So first time I went to recruit selection, smashed it.
Yeah.
And they said, congratulations, you've passed. So which infantry unit do you want to join? I was like, I'm joining the engineers. And I was like, And actually, the recruiter, the major, was a parachute regiment. He was trying to convince me to join the paras.
Yeah.
And I was like, mate, I don't think I can do that. And, you know, I changed my option to engineers. My mother will kill me if I do that. So,
yeah, sure.
Went back, joined the engineers. And as soon as they mentioned bomb disposal and basic training, I was like, yep.
Where did you do the basic? Where did you
just go? Litchfield.
Litchfield.
Which I'm pretty sure doesn't exist anymore. I think it's been sold off.
Couldn't tell you. Don't know.
It's, trust me, it's no loss. It's an absolute shuttle.
Yeah. So I went to Harrogate because I was such a young'un. I was 16 when I did mine. So
I was a bit later than that. I mean, mm-hmm. I could have gone to that, but because I did the army prep course, that took 6 months. That delayed it all a bit. Sure. And going to recruit selection, they had to fail me the first time because the system, apparently they can pass you, but only for whatever it says on the system. Yeah, no, typical
madness.
Yeah, so that delayed it. So I didn't actually start basic till a week after I turned 17.
Right.
So
is that over the cap for Harrogate?
You basically have to. So that is pretty much from high school and a set day you go to Harrogate.
Yeah. So how do you define basic being? Because you're still young at 17.
Yeah.
You know, 16, 17 is no difference.
I wasn't the youngest, but I mean, I think there's maybe two younger than me. One of which quit in the first week.
Yeah.
And they ever got back trooped at about week 10. So
you're the baby of the platoon.
I was, yeah. And I was the skinniest guy there. I mean, I couldn't put on weight no matter what I did. I mean, you look at me now, you wouldn't think skinny is how I describe myself.
Hey, I was the same,
but I couldn't put on weight. Didn't matter what I ate, how much fizz I did, how little fizz I did.
Yeah.
Throughout like the years, I was trying to build up to it. But I struggled in basic, I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to be easy, is it?
Well, it's not that. I mean, my section commander was... at the time, I hated him, but looking back on it, I thank the bloke.
Yeah.
He was very hard on me. And there were certain things, instead of just, advising me to maybe change certain things, it wasn't until I actually got to Jib Barracks to start doing my combat engineering. They said, your webbing's set up wrong and your bergen's far too high. This is all wrong. Your boots aren't even the right size. And it wasn't until then that I realised I've basically been going through all this with kit that's not set up properly and it hurt and it was really uncomfy. And as soon as I had kit that fit properly and was set up properly, it went from being very difficult to, well, actually, this is pretty easy now because I've been used to it being so horrible for so long that now it's actually pretty good. And I went from being considered... the weakest link in the troop. So at the end of my, my combat engineer training, came second overall.
How long is that combat engineer training?
Oh, God, I think it's about 15, 16 weeks, roughly that. I can't actually remember. That was back in 2007, I think. So
do you train as sort of a counter ID specialist there, or is it like a...
It's a specialty. Back then, it used to be a specialty, not just a trade, whereas now it's a trade. Mm-hmm. So for combat engineers, I did basic training, which is 14 weeks.
Yep.
And then it was off to Jib Barracks to do combat engineering, which I think is 15 or 16 weeks. And then you do your trade.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I was a fabricator. And that's one of the main reasons I joined the engineers, was to get an artisan trade. So I was trained to be a welder, blacksmith, and sheet metal fabricator. So that's where I was doing it. Because my advice from Dave, who ran the army prep course, was going infantry is great, but when you're trying to get out there and trying to get another job. Now, I know completely differently now because I recruit veterans like that. It's not true at all. So I thought, God, I don't want to be Dave and get to the end of it all and be like, well, what am I going to do now because my qualifications aren't relevant, which I know it's not true now, but at the time when you're told that by someone you know and trust, that you completely believe it. So I joined the engineers to get a trade. Wasn't a very good welder. Wasn't a very good blacksmith, but sheet metal fabrication I was pretty good at. So I did that, and that was 9 months. And then you get to your unit, and once you get to your unit, then you go away and do, there's both advanced search and EOD, so explosive ordnance disposal.
Was that your choice, or did they
I volunteered for that in basic training,
right?
And this was back in 2007, so IEDs weren't a big thing really in Afghanistan or Iraq. They were still really only just starting to come along.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the ones in Iraq could have been mitigated because they were passive or active infrared sensors. Sure. So certain bits of equipment could mitigate that. So it wasn't really the same kind of threat it was in Afghan later. So back then, you'd volunteer to join that regiment and they'd basically look at your academic scores because it's quite a technical job. And unless you were really smart enough, they wouldn't take you. So in my troop, when I did my combat engineering, there was three of us that volunteered to join the regiment, and two of us got in. So obviously it became very different later. About 2012, half the engineers coming out of Jib Barracks were sent to a search unit because there was such a high turnaround. It wasn't just because of injuries, it was people trying to get out of those units and people doing one deployment and being like, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
So it was a high turnaround. So I volunteered for that and joined my regiment. That would have been, God, when was it now? Would have been late 2007, I believe.
Yeah.
And it wasn't till when was it now? It must have been early 2008 that I actually went away and started doing my search course. So your search course, I can't actually remember how long that is. I think it's 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Do that. And then I went back to my unit. And then a few months later, I was given the opportunity to do the bomb disposal aspect as well. So there's the two aspects of my regiment. There's advanced search and bomb disposal.
Yeah.
And if you do both, it's you will never leave that regiment. So once you've done both, you will only ever get sent from squadron to squadron.
Bounce around.
So actually, at the same, but the thing is, I like that. I like the idea of that. I mean, combat engineering, I enjoyed it. You know, it was difficult, but building bridges was not really one of my favourite things to do. I'd rather be, you know, blowing stuff up. So
yeah, sure.
That's why I volunteered for that.
Sure. So the deployment, once you got to your unit, did you have much time to sort of settle in your unit before?
Yeah, I mean the thing about my unit, back then, we only had one deployable squadron.
Right.
So because IEDs were such, it wasn't really a huge threat in Iraq or Afghanistan at the time, the regiment would have one squadron that would deploy, and you'd try and cycle people around to go in that squadron, so everyone, you know, does their fair share. So my squadron, called 5-8, we were actually created after the Brighton bombing. So we basically do stuff in black kit. So we go around, we have emergency response vehicles, everyone thinks we're police.
Yeah,
and we do UK stuff, whether it be counter-terror, whether it be, you know, an active job as if in just searching a venue for a, a big conference or whatever it would be. And there's other squadrons that deal with World War II ordnance, and we'd kind of both share the burden, well, not the burden, but like some of the MI pages, which is working with the SBS and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it was mostly UK based, and it wasn't till late 2007 that there was this talk about the whole regiment reshuffling. So then every squadron then has mixed bomb disposal, mixed search, and would deploy, you know, they do their 6 month deployment, then go on 6 month training, then 6 months UK ops and 6 month deployment again.
Wow.
So whereas most units would have, you know, they'd have 6 months, you know, they deploy squadron at a time, it'd be 6 month deployment, 6 month rest, 6 month training, 6 month, you know, UK ops, but we didn't have that extra squadron. So it was...
That's an intense tempo.
But I really enjoyed being in my unit, and because we're on pages all the time, because, you know, being UK ops, you can't drink, you can't go more than half hour away from the barracks.
Yeah.
There's no phone signal there. We have a massive radar dish right next to it, which is the backup for Stansted. So no phone signal. But the good thing is, because they knew that the job was a bit crap, we had good accommodation. That's so you have your own room, your own shower.
Yeah.
And being a gamer, it was brilliant. I had internet in my room, so I had my Xbox. And being on pager all weekend, for most people, was like horrible. But for me, the chances are I'm skint, so I couldn't afford to go home anyway. So I'd be like, boom, I'm on Halo all weekend.
Yeah,
but this is
great.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So,
but I suppose when you have a temper like that, you tend to keep current as well with the threat, and especially with the guys rotating through. Because, you know, theatre changes.
It changes month by month. Even UK ops, the equipment changes all the time.
Yeah.
And most of our equipment was highly classified and stored like in a bunker, like below ground. And, you know, you're not allowed to take your phone in, you know, you're not allowed to even write down the name of the equipment you're using because it's that, you know, that secret. Yeah. So it sounds really cool, but a lot of the time you are sat around doing not much, because when you're on pager, you know, just the pager requirements for the regiment, at any given time you'd have about 40 people on pager, because you have pagers on backup pages.
Mm-hmm.
You have like the bombs pager, the search pager, the MI pager, and a few others that, you know, I can't mention. You know, all these other pages, and there's a team that has to be on standby, which is like 11 men, plus their backup.
Yeah.
And for most operators, we don't really go on exercises too often. We can't go too far. So for the army, we didn't really do all that much. There was, you do your fizz, you go to your troop office, make sure your kit's ready, and there'd be a lot of waiting around.
Yeah.
So you didn't really get the same adventure training opportunities as other regiments would. But at the same time, you know, I enjoyed what I did. So it was all good by me.
Yeah, I suppose that's the downside to the trade you're in, but you get to do cool stuff as well.
That's true.
So you deployed Herrick... Was that your first tour, operational tour?
That was my first deployment. Yeah, I was 19 at the time as well. So that was my first deployment, and I wasn't sure. My family. It was interesting with my family. They were obviously worried about me, but I kept saying, "Well, oh, yeah, don't worry. It's fine. There'll be infantry around."
Yeah,
and obviously, they knew what I was doing. But obviously, they didn't really realise that was the risk.
Sure.
So yeah, so my family was worried about me getting shot and this, that, and the other. But obviously, they didn't. I didn't lie to them. I just didn't tell them that, you know, IEDs is the big threat, and I'm going out to look for the one thing everyone else is trying to avoid.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's one of the at the time it was one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. But obviously, I didn't tell them that.
No.
Because that would not go down well. But I wouldn't change any of it, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously, I was on Herrick 10 as well, doing fire support team for the Welsh Guards. Were you a brigade asset, or were you? I suppose you were a brigade asset.
We're kind of brigade level. So later deployments, there was enough search teams, and IODD teams and EOD teams that all the major FOBs would have a team that would be static in that FOB. Whereas we had 10 teams total. We're having to move around all over the place. So we're on pager. So I think. We're on the Chinooks more than probably anyone else in theatre was, you know, obviously excluding obviously the pilots and stuff. So we're in Chinooks every few days going to somewhere new, and that was, you know, that was important to keep moving teams around because certain ATOs or AMOTEC officers work different from others. Mm-hmm. Some search teams would work different from others. So you'd move them around to keep the, you know, keep the Taliban guessing exactly what's going on, and keep you current, because some areas the threat may be higher, maybe lower, there may be something new that you would learn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they move the teams around a lot, and it was a lot of pages. So
I suppose it makes the talker quicker as well, moving around and being static in one location.
I mean, we spoke earlier about this, being down in Nadi Ali. I mean, that was my first op. Mm-hmm. We were down there for 2 weeks on the first op. That was great fun. literally, within a second of being out the back of the Viking, the first time that I was actually on Afghan ground outside of a base, bullets going overhead, literally within seconds, and that was probably one of the most intense jobs we did, and I got accommodation for that, so that was cool.
That's brilliant.
So that was pretty intense, and then you go from somewhere like Nadi Ali where IEDs are big and obvious.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be fair, you can spot them from 50 metres away. You don't really need to use metal detectors or anything like that. And then you go off to, say, Sangin, where they're every 5-10 metres and they are very intricate and very well hidden and very difficult to find. But then we later went back to Nadi Ali again and the IEDs have completely changed. So in 2009, you know, I actually found the first completely undetectable pressure plate in Afghan. Wow. So you could touch it with a metal detector, you wouldn't find a thing. You wouldn't get any signal at all. Yeah, that was...
It's funny because Herrick 10, at one point, we patrolled freely at night, patrolled freely at day. There was rumours of IEDs, but in Nadi Ali, we didn't really hear about it. And then, literally overnight, it was like they just spread like a virus overnight. We couldn't move.
Yeah.
Like, we couldn't move at night because we couldn't see. And then our movement during the day was halved because of the time it took to cover distance.
And that's the issue, is that they're just doing it to try and slow us down, to try and slow us down and give themselves some more room. Yeah. But IEDs changed a lot. It did, yeah. I think overall, down in Nadi Ali, we were there for 2 weeks first off. As a team, I think we'd found like 15, 20 devices, I think, that we got rid of.
Yeah.
My boss, his IED count by the end of the deployment was 140 odd. So bear in mind, we didn't do a full 4 month deployment because I got injured and other people in the team got injured as well. So in 4 months, he found more his team dealt with more IEDs than any team like has in Afghan or Iraq ever. And it's bear in mind, that's compared to 6 month deployments, and that was in four months. So I believe the tally was 140 odd in 4 months.
Unbelievable.
So good fun though. We got shot at a lot as well. That was cool.
Yeah, you're the prime target on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, they'll target us. I mean, like I said earlier about when we were in Nadi Ali, there was an op where they specifically targeted our boss, because you find an IED, no one goes near it until the ATO gets there, because it's obviously a threat.
Yeah.
And it was just a big come on, and we came under a massive attack by the enemy. And you know, we didn't call in any fire support, but the Americans were in the area and they saw the tracer and they thought we'd just come in and join in. So rifles down, cameras out, and we had two attack helicopters and two Hueys just leveling this one compound for us. It was brilliant.
That'll do it. That'll do it.
Yeah. So that was interesting. And then, funny enough, they didn't try that again. But the issue was my boss's radio was broken. And he was stuck in a bomb crater, stuck to the ground for about an hour, unable to move because they were just shooting at him.
Yeah.
And he couldn't move. He had no cover. He was literally stuck to the ground for an hour. And he was yet trying to shout at us, and we were 100 metres away, and we're all returning fire. We can't hear. We couldn't see him because he was in a ditch.
Yeah.
That was interesting. It wasn't till after that he got a little frustrated that we didn't see that he was stuck in a ditch and he was yelling at us. But his radio was not working.
It's not our fault, boss. You're getting your head down. Yeah. Give him a brew.
But no, that was intense.
Yeah. So. Fast forward a few months, you were Sangin.
Sangin, yeah. Delightful place.
Delightful place.
Yep.
So many injuries there from IEDs. I think more injuries from IEDs than small arms.
By a long way. I mean, the med centre there was always busy. You know, it'd be civilians going in as well. So, you know, the Taliban would put IEDs everywhere with actually no regard for, you know, what they consider their own people. You know? So that was, that pissed me off more than anything, that, you know, you claim that these are your people and you're doing this to them.
Yeah.
And that annoyed me more than anything. Yeah. But
very hypocritical.
It is.
So if you don't mind talking through
yep.
the day in question of the injury day.
The day in question, that was an interesting one. We were supposed to go out at first light. So Pharmacy Road is the main road that links Fob Rob to, I can't remember, is it Inkerman, I think it is, the other side, yeah. It's the main road, so it's 2 kilometres. And, you know, you look at all the people that are killed in Sangin, so there's 106 total being killed in Sangin. The vast majority of them were killed on Pharmacy Road, or maybe the road's just off to the side of it. And that was the biggest threat. And we had done jobs where we'd cleared big parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
There was one where a combat tractor got damaged and was left there. That took us a week to get that out. And just to get that out, they'd lost like several guys doing that, because you clear a bit, you clear your route up to it, and then you maybe have to abandon the op because suicide bomber risk, or you're getting dicked or something like that. So you'd have to abandon it and go back the next day and do the same thing. But by the time we actually got to it, it'd been properly booby-trapped. They put IEDs, under it, next to it, all around it. And that was just one job, just to recover a piece of equipment that we couldn't deny because it was so well armoured, we couldn't blow it up, we had to recover that. So we'd done various ops down Pharmacy Road before, but on the day that I was injured, we were supposed to go out at first light to clear all of Pharmacy Road, which we thought would take us all day. So obviously the infantry cordon went out before us, and there was cordon sent from both ends, and it was just going to be like a roaming cordon with us. Mm-hmm. So we'd clear bits for them, and, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then we got a call, well, not a call, but... one of the pages went off and we were told, that op's being stood down for now. You're going over to Fob Edinburgh because they found a bomb factory. And we then had to wait for a Chinook to turn up. And the Chinook turns up, and to our surprise, the first thing that comes out the back of it is the brigade commander and a BBC camera crew. And I actually saw the footage of us getting back in the back of the Chinook when I was in hospital, which was amazing.
Yeah.
So we go, get the back of the Chinook, and we fly to Fob Edinburgh and go out to this... this compound, and we used a lot of our explosives trying to isolate that, make sure there's no command wires going, because they could take out a whole team if they did. Wasted a lot of our bar mines, ground clearance charges, and all that stuff, just trying to isolate this. And by the time we actually got on the compound, we found a kilogram of heroin, a moped battery, and a bag of washers, and that was it. So no ceremony, bombs have been made there. So we'd wasted the whole day and a lot of our explosives just trying to isolate that. By the time we finally got back to Sangin, it would have been about 11 at night. And basically told, you're still going out, you're still going to, the infantry cordon has been out all day, so you're still going out to clear all the Pharmacy Road at night.
Oh, my God.
And we had a new team commander.
Whose decision was that?
I have no idea. That was way above my head.
Yeah.
But we had a new team commander. So my previous team commander, he dislocated his shoulder on a previous op. Mm-hmm. So we then got a replacement team commander. Now, bear in mind, the work we were doing was like the really dangerous stuff. Our replacement team commander... when you're isolating, looking for command wires, the man at the front is the team commander.
Yeah.
He's using a Valor metal detector. So Cookie had never used a Valor metal detector before. He'd never been to Afghanistan before. He'd never actually been a team commander on a real search job before.
Amazing.
And it was the first time for everything for him. And he was told, you are now lead man in Sangin looking for IEDs with a Valor. Whereas for about a month before that, I'd been volunteering as a team commander's job in isolation. So I was the point man carrying more kit with a Valor, looking for any IEDs as we're looking
for the cables.
Yeah, because the alternative was, we have someone that's been a team commander before but has never touched the equipment, and you're probably the best in the team with this equipment. You're definitely the quickest, so you're going point man, and you're the smallest bloke, so they're going to try and shoot you. Good luck, because you're like 4 foot nothing. So I volunteered for that. And then on the day of the op, Cookie, he was naturally, I don't blame him, I think he was a bit flapping. He didn't say that, but I said, I'll do it again. I've been doing it for weeks. I've only got 2 days left in Sangin. I'm not going to jack on you and be like, oh, you can do that now, because I've got 2 days before I go off back to Camp Bastion. So I volunteered, and starting close to an Afghan National Army Sangha. So we have that false sense of protection there, because there's a Sangha. And we have at the first junction where there's intel, there's a command wire device at the junction.
Yeah.
And we're going to just go clear that.
For the listeners that don't know, a command wire is...
So a command wire, basically, there's two types of IED. There's victim operated and there's something that's commanded by, the enemy. So victim operated is you stand on it, you trip it or whatever it is, and they're just left as, literally the victim to operate. But command wire, it's a long cable, and there's something at the other end of a battery and a switch, and they're waiting for you to get near it, and then it'll just flip a switch and it'll go bang. So there's no mitigation for that. The only way you can counter that is by finding the cable. So if you have a road or a junction you're searching, you have special equipment that looks for cables. So I can't tell you distances and stuff, but you do a big isolation around. So you don't go through the junction, you do a big loop around it, and you look for the cables going in. And our cable detectors are actually very accurate. If there's a cable anything longer than like a meter, you'd find it.
Mm.
So we'd whiz around and do that. So we're going on this isolation to check this first junction, because we had local intelligence, there's a command wire device there.
Yeah.
And off we go, we're going around this junction. I think we're going around clockwise. And about a meter away from a very big, obvious device, I stopped and told the boss, there's an IED there, I don't even need to go and uncover it. You can see the pressure plate from here.
Yeah.
Now, I thought in my mind, we're close to that Sanger. So clearly they dug it in quickly to not to be seen. So that's why it's been sloppily done.
Yeah.
And, you know, our ATO was brilliant. And he thought, you know, if I blow that up, that's going to take time. So there's going to be one on the other side of the road. So we'll bound back and just blow them up at the same time. That'll save us 10, 15 minutes. Like, happy days. Yeah. So we go back and then we go to the other side of the road. And we have to go through these compounds. Then we're going to go around counterclockwise. And I come to this doorway, so a vulnerable point that you'd normally never go through.
Yeah.
Normally we'd just blow a hole in the wall, but we didn't have bar mine charges. So we didn't have that. So basically it was a case where I need to go through that door, and the walls are too high to climb over. They're a good 18 foot. We didn't have ladders. All our kit
was
not going to work.
Yeah.
So I search up towards the doorway, and the team's stacked up, and they're all going parallel to a wall. There's probably 3 or 4 meter gaps between us, so we're not all bunched up too close. I search up the door, metal detector. Nothing. And it's almost like spider sense of tingling. I mean, I've been in there long enough and done off the dangerous stuff to know that there should be a device here somewhere. And then I like bounded back, went it straight out the door. And it wasn't so much that, oh, I might find something different this time, so you can see it from a different angle. Searched again, absolutely nothing. And then bound around another 90 degrees and searched against in the wall and the floor in front of the door. Nothing. And it was like, okay, so maybe it's a no metal content or a muff fuse or whatever it may be that you can't detect a metal detector. Got prone, started scraping around in the dirt, all sorts. Couldn't see anything. The ground sign, there was no ground sign. It wasn't like someone had recently been digging there, because someone had recently been digging there, then we probably would have found another way around or used a ground clearance charge to just clear that ground to make sure there's nothing there. And then, you know, I got up and I looked at my team commander. Bear in mind, I was static at the time. Looked at my team commander, who was, I was looking at my team, my friend Jay, and there's a guy behind him was team commander, like, Cookie, there's nothing here. And it was almost like, you know, it doesn't compute, there should be. And it's like, hang on, I'll check with the boss. And it was around that time it functioned. No one was moving, so we can only presume it's command wire, but we don't know for definite. And I mean, this was 2 minutes to midnight, which, being an Iron Maiden fan, is pretty cool, actually, because one of my favourite songs. And then it was just a, you know, I know I've seen it in films and people, you know, books, and they try to explain it and like time slows down. I mean, that is what it's like. It seemed like an eternity that I just, the sensation of falling and then I hit something. So basically I've been blown from one side and hit the wall on the other and then hit the ground.
Yeah.
So I felt those hits, and cause it was very dark out, the moon state was like next to none. Everything was still bright white, and then it just like faded to black. And then I'm just lying there, and you know, I could hear myself like breathing and, you know, like everything was really slow. And then it was like, what happened? I mean, have I been shot? Was there a suicide bomb on the other side of the door? I mean, that was another threat. So that was always a threat, suicide bombers. So I always have a metal detector on the left hand, weapon in my right. And so that's obviously clipped onto the top of my body armor. Mm-hmm. And because I was approaching the door, safety was off because...
It's all ready to go.
Yeah, my weapon was set on repetition as well. So just in case... You know, sunk on the other side of the door, and obviously once I get through the door, safety's back on. It's a single shot again, but so that was that. And I thought, what happened is that, you know, we had some intelligence. There was potentially a suicide bomber in the area, but you know they're not very credible though. So I don't know what's happening, and you know, there's dust and everything starts to settle. And as you know, I can feel my heart beating really hard, and it takes probably about a few seconds, and then you just feel the blood leaving your body.
Mm.
I mean, you're a squatty, you know, it's like when you get hammered and you piss yourself, it's like that, you feel that warm liquid, it's like that. But I could feel it pumping, and I knew that instantly that it was blood, and I knew what happened. So it's a surreal experience, actually feeling your own blood leaving your body.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd lost a lot of strength. I tried to sit up. I don't think I did. I mean, I don't know if I ever saw my right hand. I've had some weird drug-induced dreams where I remember seeing it, but I don't know if that's completely in my head or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Bizarrely, my hand was intact. but it was a big hole in my wrist.
Right.
But I do remember looking at my left hand. Mm-hmm. By that point, my team commander and my mate Davey, they were over me. So he ignored commands to stay static because sure. they knew there's other devices.
Yeah.
He basically told the boss to go fuck himself and grab the med kit and just ran in pitch black into the dust at night, not knowing where the hell I was.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't got to me when he did, I mean, I would have died. I mean, yeah. they told my family for days after my injuries, you know, for about 3 days that I was going to die.
Yeah.
They gave me like no chance. But if Davey hadn't got to me when he did, I mean, I would have been gone. I mean, you know, they reckon I had no more than a pint of blood in me.
Wow.
You know, at that point. So I'd later heard that, you know, they reckon I had no more than a pint of blood in me. And wow. Obviously, my team got to me before the medic did. Davey was a brilliant medic, actually. Yeah. And he actually got a bravery award for what he did. And if he hadn't moved, I think the rest of the team eventually would have.
Yeah.
But seeing him just being the guy who was furthest from mm-hmm, me, mm-hmm. you know, with no night vision on, you know, big dust cloud, just grab his kit and just run. Everyone's yeah. just followed him. And he got to me first. And then my team sergeant Gaz, he got there, and then he went on to blind me with my Surefire, but I lent him my spare Surefire. Yeah. Never got that back, by the way.
So he's blinding me.
That's cool. I've forgiven him. For just blinding me with this Surefire, you know, trying to keep me, you know, awake and with it. You know, got my body armor off, and people like pinning my legs, like tourniquets sure. on.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I couldn't see what was going on. Actually, having that light blinding me was actually a good thing because I had something to focus on. And he was trying to just, talk to me, and. Yeah, and I just remember looking at my left hand because there's burns on the back of it, but it's not too bad. But my left thumb was hanging off.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at that and I was playing with it, just like a kid would play with like a random toy, thinking, yeah, yeah. that's not right. Why does this not hurt? And why is my thumb hanging off?
Yeah.
And I just remember looking at that. And that was, you know, what I saw. And obviously, I could hear the team, you know, yelling at each other and putting tourniquets in. And then the medic team put a cannula in my arms to give me fluids and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, stay with us, stay conscious. And it's weird because there was no pain. But for some reason, you just can't help but scream.
Yeah.
And I think it's an adrenaline thing. I think need that adrenaline. And it didn't hurt, but I asked for morphine anyway because I knew eventually it's going to hurt,
definitely.
Yeah. So that was that. And I mean, my last words would have been interesting because my boss, Gaz, was trying to keep me, you know, awake, trying to keep me conscious, keep me with it. And we were just talking, you know, talking about, you know, your girlfriend, tell me about her, et cetera, et cetera. So Gaz was trying to, you know, keep me with it. And I think the only reason I survived is because, you know, I was quite fit. I was a small bloke, but carried probably the heaviest kit. And, you know, I had a really low resting heart rate. So I think that really did me good. And because there wasn't much of me to keep alive, I think that's what kept me going. So Gaz was trying to keep me, you know, lucid, just talking and with it, you know. And it's got to the point where, you know, I was struggling to stay awake.
Yeah.
And, you know, my last words would have been, Gaz, shut up. I don't want to talk to you anymore. As you know, my vision went, and the last thing I heard was a rumbling noise, which is apparently a quad bike.
Right.
And I was conscious for half hour. It doesn't seem like it. It seemed like it was only a few minutes, but yeah. The only reason they said it was half hour is because they had half hour of like the paralumes up to keep the area illuminated. Apparently they had a half hour of that, and you know that's what they used, and that's the only reason I know it was half hour that I was apparently conscious.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, your life flashes before your eyes and stuff like that. But, I mean, I was 20 at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I hadn't really lived much. So
that went quite quick, that flash.
Well, it's not so much that. It wasn't the, you know, the life flashing before your eyes. You know, you think about the things you haven't done.
Yeah,
the things
yeah.
that you want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, my girlfriend, you know, we've been together just shy of 2 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we're now married. And the whole thought of marriage hadn't really crossed my mind until that moment.
Wow.
So that was my last thought. So yeah.
Did you spend much time in Bastion, or was it straight to the UK?
I had two operations in Camp Bastion, 19 yeah. hours total.
The hospital there is unreal.
I can't remember it, to be
yeah.
fair.
Yeah.
But the problem, I was such a stubborn bastard that they kept trying to put me to sleep and I kept regaining consciousness. So I had an American, a Black Hawk, pick me up because it yeah. was quicker than a Chinook.
The Pedro, was it?
Yeah. yeah. And I regained consciousness in the helicopter.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was the first triple amputee that didn't have a cardiac arrest.
All right.
So the two previous that I know, they both had numerous, you know, even before they got to the operating theatre.
Yeah.
And I never did. And they obviously got me straight in, you know, into the theatre, but I regained consciousness in the Black Hawk. But by that point, they gave me ketamine, which I can't remember, thankfully.
Yeah.
But apparently I was talking, and I regained consciousness. And I had the first operation that was about 9 hours straight.
Wow.
And then something started going funny. So they decided to put me in recovery, far less stress. And they thought, there's no way he's going to recover. And I recovered consciousness. And they smuggled, you know, the guy, Davey, who saved my life, and a few of my other teammates, they smuggled them into the hospital to come and see me. And there was the, my commanding officer was there as well. And I started to have a go at him. I was really frustrated that he made my team walk back. So they're out on the ground, and I'd just been blown up. And I said, you could at least give them a vehicle, but you made them, you know, walk back. and there I am as a young sapper, you know, saying some very inappropriate things to a lieutenant colonel. But it's interesting. You actually learn a lot of things years down the line that I never knew happened. So, you know, as one of the officers in my squadron, you know, didn't know the bloke very well, didn't really like him that much, to be fair. And I didn't realize until a few months ago that he was actually in the operating theater the whole time. So both my officer commanding, who's, you know, major in charge of the joint, you know, wasn't there, the sergeant major wasn't actually in Camp Bastion at the time, they're off elsewhere, and he was the officer in charge, and he didn't know what to do. And he bumped into a sergeant who was a friend of his father's, and he said, like, he's one of my guys, I just want to make sure he's okay. And he didn't know what to do, so he stood in the corner of the operating theater for 10 hours straight, just stood in the corner, not knowing what to do. And that's a guy I never, you know, didn't really know that much about, and I didn't realize that for years he'd done that and never told me that he just was in the corner, just not knowing what to do, but just making sure that,
you know, there's
someone that, you know, I knew that was there. And so I regained consciousness after my first operation. I thought, no, that wasn't going to happen. As my heart rate and everything steadied, and, you know, I had enough blood in me, they went back for more surgery. But that initial operation, I had 100 units of blood.
Wow.
100 points going through me. And since then, I've had another 50 in other operations, which is a little frustrating. I used to donate blood, but I could only do one unit a month or something.
But
I'm not allowed to donate blood anymore because I received it in surgery. I can never do it again.
Right, okay.
So it's a law in the UK, which I feel a bit bad about that, because I've taken a lot but not actually given anything back.
Well, it's down to the rest of us to give, I think.
Yeah, so so that was that. And I regained consciousness on the medevac back as well. So I had, there's a different plane that literally is a flying operating theatre. And that rarely gets used, because that's only for, like, the really, you know, they had a surgeon on board, they had a full medical team and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And I regained consciousness. And apparently, you get, like, this little diary and people writing notes in it. And I was reading that, it's quite emotional. And I was reading that, and I don't know who the nurse was. And apparently, I was talking about getting a Happy Meal or something. And I was like, I don't even like McDonald's. Why do I even say that? So I'm having these weird conversations with people when I'm on ketamine and morphine and just away with the fairies.
Well, that's the power of ketamine for you.
But then I got back to the UK, and then I was in a drug induced coma for, what was it? I'm trying to think, it would have been 7 days. And ironically, I actually woke up on what was the second anniversary for me and my girlfriend. Now wife. So that was, you know, probably the worst anniversary we've had. And then I was in intensive care for a further 2 weeks beyond that. I mean, my injuries were quite severe. It was, that was back when it was Celiac, before it became the Queen Elizabeth. But I mean, at the time, they're saying I was, like, the second worst injury to survive. I mean, how they worked that out, I don't know. I had no permanent damage to my eyesight. I can still talk. And there's some people that, you know, lost their eyesight and got paralyzed. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're worse injured than me. But I don't know how they work this out. I think it's just on a list of most injuries and stuff. But I did have quite a few injuries. And obviously, you know, my left thumb got blown off. I had a chunk of shrapnel taken from my left bicep that almost cut my left arm as well. Right hand is gone. Bit of shrapnel went through my wrist. And like I said about having my rifle ready to go, impact of the explosion made my rifle fire, which put a round through the top of my right thigh, and I still got a scar from that.
Oh, wow.
And that hit a friend of mine in the chest, and he kept the bullet, so I'm a little annoyed about that. Because that actually went through me. That hit his plate, and he kept it.
Right.
So he got
technically
that.
You own it.
Yeah. You know, I've got flesh rights.
Yeah.
And obviously both legs high are gone. I had a tear in my abdomen from roughly my left hip to, like, my belly button.
Yeah.
My bladder got popped. I think my bowel. I had a third of my intestines removed. I had a perforated stomach, lacerated liver. I had my spleen removed. I had a fractured skull, fractured eye socket, including my eye apparently popped out as well. I'm not sure how true that is, but someone did say that my eye was dislocated at one point. What else was there? Both eardrums popped. I had shrapnel in my eyes. And various scars all over the place. And I had a bit of shrapnel that went straight up through. And that stopped in contact with my diaphragm just below my heart. So that was extremely lucky. So, I mean, those two injuries were insane, and that's why they basically said I wasn't going to survive.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I've actually become friends with the surgeon who operated on me. So
that's amazing.
He's a brilliant surgeon.
How did you find out who it was?
It's through Emma Willis's charity, actually. Right. So So me and some of the guys, we had a photo shoot. So I'm not sure if you covered Emma Willis's charity Style for Soldiers or anything.
Not yet.
Okay. So I'm actually ambassador for that charity.
Yep.
And when I was in Headley Court, I was introduced to Emma, and Emma was actually the first person that was not medical or military that I'd spoken to post-injury.
Yeah.
And I was really uneasy about it. I didn't like any physical contact because generally it involved needles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I felt really uneasy because at the time I had both a catheter and a colostomy bag, and I felt really awkward just being physical contact with anyone. And then she was like trying to measure me for a shirt and stuff. So it was, I thought, why do I need a shirt? And the only reason I did it is because someone basically said, you know, don't be a pussy.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. And then someone said, do you know how much these shirts cost? And you know what squatties are like. Who tells something's got value? You'll take it.
Yeah, sure.
Doesn't matter if you need it or not, you'll take it. So Emma's charity, what really started as just a supposed to be a nice gift.
Yeah.
Because Emma didn't know what to do. So her father was a Gurkha officer in Singapore. And she didn't know what to do, and she's like, "What can I do?" And I was like, "Well, I make bespoke shirts. I mean, at least I can do that. It'll be something. It'll be a nice thing to have." And most people have never had a bespoke anything. I mean, you asked me prior to that what a shirt was. It'd be like, you know, £2.50 down Primark. You wear it once and bin it because it's horrible. But you know, Emma turns out, you know, and she's, you know, she was loving him, just chatting. And at that point, you know, like I said about my wife and getting married and stuff, and obviously by that point I'd bought an engagement ring and everything. So we're talking about weddings, which is quite bizarre. And then every time I saw Emma for years, it was just talking about randomly wedding dresses and weddings and stuff, which is not something you'd expect to ever hear at Headley Court.
Sure.
So I met Emma, and then years later I moved to London for a work placement at Barclays, which we'll get into later. And my wife had just finished her fashion design degree at university. And one of the patrons, Lisa Armstrong, is a fashion editor of one of the big newspapers. I can't remember which one it was at the time. She's still doing that. And I saw Emma. I just happened to be back in Headley Court following a rather routine operation. I had to go back for 2 weeks rehab, and it just happened she was there. I'd not seen her for years. And I asked her, and it was like, you know, I mean, previously Lisa did come to Headley Court, and Bryony wasn't here at the time, and she missed that. And I think it'd be good to introduce them. And 5 minutes later, I was going to invite her party. And at the time, my confidence was terrible. I hated going to parties.
Sure.
And I was like, I don't ever wear shirts. I don't, you know, I wear whatever's comfy.
Yeah. I made a t-shirt.
Yeah. I wore them to work, you know, my workplace, my bike, but outside of work, I'd never do that.
Yeah.
So I got invited to this, and really, because it was for my wife, I went along. And I was extremely awkward. And, you know, I sat in the corner of this room. And to be fair, if someone asked me what the benefit for the charity was, well, they give you free clothes. I didn't understand, the impact of that.
Yeah.
And obviously, the more I got involved with the charity, the more I went to these events, the more I realised the importance of that, because it's a charity that fills a void that no one's ever really thought of, and that was never deemed to be an issue. And it's a confidence thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you look at military personnel, their confidence comes from two things. That's their physical ability and their appearance.
Sure.
You know, you've got your uniform, you're smart, you know, you're physically capable. Now, I went from being very physically capable to actually then being vexed by a curb.
Sure.
So, you know, I was physically different, and my confidence was terrible. And, you know, going to these events and getting the opportunity to meet people that have been there, you know, previously, it's all these people that had been previously injured that I've not seen for years, and seeing them years later, you know, in a much better state.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, their families married, new job, or they may even prosthetics, who knows? But just seeing people later down the line, it's just that getting people back together, you know, it really helped with confidence, and that really helped my mental health. And then I became an ambassador for that. And, you know, from the first event I went to, where I sat in the corner, I was very timid and was ready to talk to anyone, to the point that Emma was bringing people over just to talk to me.
Yeah.
To now being the ambassador and often speaking at these events.
That's brilliant. And that's Style for Soldiers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so anyone that's in complex trauma, you know, she'll provide with bespoke clothing. And it's not just shirts now.
Yeah.
I've been given 3 Burberry coats. I mean 3, not 3. So I've been, you know, Burberry coats, Savile Row suits, shoes if I wanted them, not needed.
Yeah.
you know, Lock & Co hats, cufflinks, belts, watches. Basically anything clothing related that will help build your confidence in, you know, your self-image. But, you know, because it's important, especially when you're, you know, someone like me, you know, how you, you know, present yourself. I mean, I'm in slob clothes today.
Yeah.
I say that, but I'm wearing McQueen and Burberry, but still. It's very important. And, you know, you go to these parties and people that years ago may have just been sat on a ward wearing just, you know, Nike shorts and just a grotty white T-shirt and are now wearing, you know, tuxes and, you know, wearing, you know, their best clothing.
Just look good, feel good as well.
Exactly, because it's that confidence piece. And no other charities really do that. They look at the mental health side of it, but I think having a lack of confidence it is a mental health issue in itself. And especially, you know, I was a very confident person, you know, pre-injury. I'd often give presentations to, you know, the Met Police, you know, and security services on our equipment and capability, because I was a massive geek and,
you know,
I knew the equipment, and they'd always often send me to do that. So even as like an 18-year-old, I'd talk in front of groups of hundreds of like ministers and people at MI5, et cetera, about our equipment. And that was fine. I liked doing that. But then post-injury, I wouldn't even go like somewhere I hadn't been before. If someone said, oh, we're going to go for, you know, go grab a coffee somewhere, and if I haven't been there before, I wouldn't go. I'd be like, no, I'm not going somewhere I don't know. And my comfort zone at one point was terrible. I'd barely leave bed. You know, I'd literally just stay in my bed.
Yeah.
Literally only ever leaving to use the toilet, and that'd be it. So my comfort zone really shrunk down. And through the charity, I've developed a lot and doing my public speaking. And
that's
now,
brilliant.
You know, my biggest crowd is 60,000 people. So I've spoken in front of a lot of people, which is very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, the charity's been really good because it does cover aspects that people don't think about. And that does subsequently help with mental health as well, without actually being registered as like a mental health charity. It's a confidence, and it's the only charity that has these get-togethers. Now, I've been to other charities' events where, you know, there'd be hundreds of people. They'd put it on the Guild Hall. It would be amazing. They'd invite loads of VIPs, and then there'd be a table of just the guys in the corner, and it was like, and then we'd show you off like cattle. Like, here's some of the people that we've helped, and I'm thinking, well, so far my involvement with your charity has been you've invited me to this meal. So, you know, you're using me as a fundraising thing. But Emma's events, it's not about that. It's just getting people back together. And the great thing about her charity is she runs it through her shop. So there's no overhead. There's no staff cost.
Yeah.
And these big events are sponsored by big charities, like big companies. So Mr. Porter sponsor the Christmas party.
Yep.
So they pay for that. So the money the charity gets goes a long way. And, you know, it's kind of international now. So I've got friends that are US veterans. That's brilliant.
It sounds like it's more of a community than like you said, showing off, oh, look who we help.
Yeah. So there's not many military charities out there that I'd say they know their beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, Blesma's very good at that because they have support officers, but everyone knows Emma. Emma knows everyone.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, they know that. It's not just a random number you call for help. It's someone that you actually know that's a friend of yours. And, you know, getting people back together is brilliant. And because anyone at Headley Court, so, you know, we have the Estonians there, because they don't have their own rehab facilities like we do. So the Christmas parties, there'll be three or four of the Estonian guys that come back, which is amazing to see them.
Yeah.
And because they don't have the same kind of charity set up in Estonia. I mean, a lot of them have done, like, charity skydives and stuff at Emma's charity because... Mm-hmm. You know, there's other charities that they just don't have the same facilities in Estonia. Yeah. So a friend of mine, a US Army veteran, he got burns in Iraq. So his vehicle caught fire. So he settled in London. I introduced him to Emma, mostly because of the scarring around his neck. And he initially said, no, I don't need shirts. They fit fine. And it's like, these are bespoke. And he said, I'll never wear another shirt again because this actually fits. It doesn't irritate my scar at all. And now he goes to all these events. So it's inadvertently become multinational. And one of her biggest supporters is ex-US Army as well. So it's inadvertently become international.
That's brilliant.
So it's a brilliant charity. So I did a photo shoot. So back to how I met H, who's the surgeon who operated on me.
Yeah.
I did a photo shoot for Mr. Porter. God, when was it? I can't remember what it was now, 2013 maybe.
Right.
And that was actually very cool. And he saw that article and he saw the pictures and he was like, I've operated on half those people. the last I saw him was actually in Selly Oak Hospital.
Yeah.
And he really impressed me because he came straight back from Afghanistan, still in uniform, went straight to Selly Oak. So he went straight to Selly Oak to see his patients and he spent hours on the ward seeing all his patients. And, you know, my mother being in the medical profession, you know, after he spoke to her and he said, honestly, I didn't think I'd ever see him alive.
Yeah.
And if he was, I thought he'd still be in intensive care 3 months later. So he was really impressed. And then he saw these pictures years later and he contacted Emma saying, I've operated on half these people. And honestly, I'd like to just get in contact to know how they're doing. Because he's a military man himself. And ironically, he's an ex-paratrooper. So he joined...
Wow, you can't say that about many paratroopers, can you?
I know. So gap year commission. And then he did gap year commission. So just 1 year commission in the parachute regiment. And then he got into Oxford University and then did medicine.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's an airborne surgeon, essentially. He's brilliant. And so he has that military sense of humour. And then he came to one of Emma's events just because he wanted to meet the guys to see how they're doing. And then he's become like a big aspect of that. And then through the charity, they created the Veterans Trauma Network. So people like me, you know, if we need surgery for the NHS, now a lot of people don't realise, a lot of the NHS surgeons actually spent time in Iraq or Afghanistan. And if you look from trauma cases from 2014 onwards, your chance of surviving trauma in the UK improved 25% from 2014. Just because, you know, surgeons like H, what they'd see every day would be the worst case they'd see in a year. And when a big attack happens and those are casualties, you get someone that's a relatively junior surgeon or doctor. It's a case of you're all they've got. Just do what you can. So the experience there was vast. And a lot of that expertise has gone back.
Medicine in itself, the progression accelerated so much due to Afghanistan.
Throughout history, you look at warfare, it's improved, medicine and science. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's terrible that it's something that has to happen for, things to improve. But all of these surgeons have gone back to the NHS, and obviously they have experience with gunshot wounds, blast mm-hmm. injuries, whatever it may be. And if I need to see a doctor, say I've got an issue with skin graft, they send me to a plastic surgeon who may specialise in burns, who may have never ever seen a blast injury before. Whereas H, he had this network of surgeons and doctors that have military experience or have deployed or have treated these injuries before. So if I have an injury, say a gunshot wound, that I've got an issue, instead of me going to my GP and saying I need to see a surgeon and you can put on a waiting list and you're a plastic surgeon, you're roughly the right person to speak to. You speak to, one person, there's a mailbox and say, I've got this issue, and they'll direct you to, the right expert.
Specialist.
Who's seen gunshot wounds, blast injuries. You get the better treatment. That's quicker. So it saves the NHS money. You get treated quicker and you get better treatment. So it's win-win just because it is saving a lot of these pointless. It's a
very efficient way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was created through Fiona's charity because she spoke to H and she realised we can do more here. And obviously the latest thing has been the arts, because a lot of charities, they focus on sports. Yeah. Now, I'm not a sportsman. I watch sports. I won't do sports. It's, the sports I like doing, I can't really do at the moment. I like shooting, but I don't drive and I have to get down to Bisley and it's just a real nightmare. So I'm just not going to bother until I win the lottery and stuff. So a lot of charities focus on sports. Now, sports are brilliant, like the Invictus Games, and Emma's been involved in the Invictus mm-hmm. thing. So the Invictus Trials in Sheffield, they had the big gig. And that was her doing. So we had a gig where there was like 20,000 people there. And that's, she did that. That wasn't a thing. She managed to throw that together herself. I went to that and it was amazing. But again, it's other charities, it's sports. And sports are great because you get people back together. And it's like I said about Emma's events, you're getting people back together, but not everyone wants to do sports. So she started looking at the arts because she had people that, trying to be artists. She met people at events that... were painters, they're doing it for therapy, like art therapy.
Of course, yeah.
And some of these people are very talented. But
they do a lot of that at blind veterans. So my mother is a care supervisor at blind veterans.
Okay.
And they have a massive sort of art studio.
Yeah.
Where it's therapy for...
Yeah, so what started as art therapy then became a career for a few people. Mm-hmm. And Emma's put on Art in the Aftermath. So it's an art exhibit that has travelled around the country. So it's been in an art gallery in Pall Mall, been down in Gloucester, for months. It was up in... Sheffield, where we did the Invictus Trials for the duration of the trials. It's been all over the place, and it's been visited by royal team, et cetera, et cetera. So it's actually been very, very good. So numerous people have done art as a form of therapy, but actually they've become pretty impressive. And there's some of the guys you'll be interviewing, Stuart and Dougie, they'll cover it in their way because they're actual artists. They know more than that. But I used to draw a lot. But I used to be right-handed, and now my handwriting is terrible. So my ability to draw is awful. I don't even bother now. It's terrible.
Yeah.
So I don't really do anything artistic. But I guess I've got my photography. Now I've got numerous cameras.
Yep.
My wife has no idea how much I spent, and I'm not going to tell her.
She doesn't need to know.
No, she doesn't need to know. So, I've been given bursaries from, Blesmer and other charities to get photography equipment. They've bought me numerous drones as well, so I've got my drone equipment.
That's brilliant.
So I've got that. That's as artistic as I get is my photography. But I've been working on these independent films. So a friend of mine at Barclays, and I've mentioned Barclays, we'll get back to that later. So Catherine, she's a good friend of mine. So she started with the British Filmmakers Alliance, which is used to try and help kickstart the UK film industry as a... It's dying slowly. There's not enough money in the industry. They get anyone talented, they go off to Hollywood, and then everything's American funded. Now, even though they make a lot of films here, they're not technically British films because they're not British funded. All the money goes back to, either Chinese or American companies. And so we're trying to help the independent film industry because independent films, there's less and less of them being made because there's less funding available. So she started that network herself after trying to make... she made a film. She actually sold her house to make it, and she realized how difficult it is, one, to make a film, but also to try and get it noticed and actually make money out of it. So she created this network. It's almost like a LinkedIn for actors looking for work, directors of photography, camera operators, directors, producers, whatever it may be. It's kind of like a little LinkedIn for people that are trying to make films in the UK.
Yeah.
She's got newsletters and stuff like that. So we started working together at Barclays, and on the side she was doing these independent films. Now, I'm a massive film geek. Yeah. I'd never thought about making films. I've only ever really, watched them. Yeah, so my friend Catherine, she was writing a film script at the time, and she was basically asking advice, from my experience, whether it be about firearms. And I'm pretty good at, you know, research. You ask me to find out something, I'll find out, you know, where one way or another. And she basically had these little plot holes in the film. It was almost like, oh, we need to find a poison that is a completely neutral, scentless, smellless, etc. poison that could kill someone under a milligram.
Yeah.
So I found that. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to watch this because I've been Googling some really weird stuff. But I found out all these things, and there was bits that was wrong with it. I was providing props and scared the hell out of some people because I brought a blank firing pistol. That was brilliant. And then I was like, this is brilliant. I love this. This is great. And then we went on to other projects, and it was a case of doing this feature film. That was about £80,000 to make that film, and that was difficult to do. So it was a case of, we need to try and just make more smaller films to try and get noticed. And through Emma's charity, I'd met Charles Dance, you know, who is an absolute legend. And I knew Charles, and we were going to do this art piece, and basically it's called Love of Words, and it's all about the, you know, perception of, you know, words and how people kind of tend to stick to the negatives. I mean, you know, someone could say they love you 100 times, but you call them a dick once, they'll remember that.
Sure.
So people tend to focus on the negative. And this whole piece is about ignore the negative things. And it's only a 5-minute film. We had various actors. We had some veterans in front of the camera, veterans behind the camera. You know, I helped produce it where I could. Yeah. And we did that in a studio in a day. I mean, the tagline I thought was actually quite powerful, that, you know, words are weapons, carry the right ones with you.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that is that's read by Charles Dance and he's on camera, which is really cool. There's numerous actual roles on a film set that would actually be brilliant for veterans now.
Yeah.
I saw that firsthand. I heard Catherine say that because she's been on a lot more film sets than I have. And I was invited to an event where Andy McNab was speaking. So I've actually seen what the man looks like. I mean, yeah. I know why he's anonymous now. Don't remember, you know, face for radio and all. But yeah. I didn't say that.
But it's true, Andy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. But he said the exact same thing. He said that actually after he left service, and it, you know, this book went, you know, Robert 2-0 went, you know, it kind of went, you know, like wildfire.
Yeah, yeah.
He was like a military advisor for like Pearl Harbor and all these films, and he basically said like a film set is a brilliant actual space for a veteran. Because there's one objective, everyone does their one piece. There's a lot of project management, and quite frankly, project management, I know it's a very civilian like term, like corporate term, but project management, anyone in the military can be a project manager. I mean, that's what my day job is. Yeah. It's managing teams. It's, you've got budgets to manage, people to manage. There's one objective, and it is intense work for maybe 12 hours straight, because you have everything's timetabled and everything is. You know, like everything's like choreographed behind the scenes as well. So it's brilliant for veterans to do that. And it is.
Well, it's working as a team as well.
It's the teamwork, yeah. I mean, there's jobs on a film set where, you know, you'd be on your own, which is, again, the military, you could be doing bits solely on your own. And there's other bits where you're working as a team. And it brings it all together. And I really enjoyed it.
There's a niche in the market there for veterans to get involved.
The problem is, the whole thing is there's just not enough films being made. And I mean, you look at. You know, that latest film, 1917, like the military advisor for that, he's done everything. I mean, he is prolific. I mean, the films he's done has been brilliant. I mean, he's an ex-paratrooper. So there's definitely people in the industry doing these things, but there's just not enough films being made, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're trying to rectify that by making films, and it's telling a story that, obviously, it's completely fictional, but at the same time, it relates to real life and real things that have happened. And the whole point is that we're trying to do it to raise... it's an issue, and to try and raise some money for charities as well. At the end, if it does make any money, money will go back to charity, and money will go into producing more films, which then again would have veterans behind the camera. Now, obviously, we're not suggesting every job in a film set can be done by veterans. The same as, like, you know, I mean, I work for Barclays, and not every job can be done by a veteran, but there's a lot of them that can be done.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really as artistic as I get. I mean, I don't do anything creative. I mean, you know, the production side of it, there's not really anything creative there. That's all down to the director, which is Catherine, the writer, again, that's Catherine, and whoever the director of photography may be. That's the artistic bit, but the rest of it is basically, here's a list of things to do. Find me a venue, find me this equipment, find me this, find me that. Do it as cheap as possible, get it in the right place at the right time. It's just moving people and equipment into the right place, which is what the military does, essentially.
Of course, on a daily basis.
Yeah, so that's as artistic as I get. And Emma sponsored our short film. She provided some of the money for the studios, and obviously then got Charles involved.
Involved
as well, which is brilliant.
That's awesome.
Who's now actually an ambassador for the charity himself. So I think he's I think he's like the arts ambassador or arts patron or something.
Right.
I don't know.
That's brilliant. There's a lot of them. Unfortunately, the arts in the UK are have taken a hit over the like past decade or so.
Yeah.
And I think it's time to have an injection by the government to try and pick the arts up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you asked me as a young soldier when I was like 19 about art, I wouldn't have a clue. I'd presume you'd just mean like some Jackson Pollock or someone just flick paint a thing and it's worth hundreds of millions. I don't get that.
Yeah.
But I mean, art has many different facets. I mean, you look at computer games, you say that's art. You know, films, TV,
musical theater,
books, music, anything. You know, probably in some way or another, can be seen as art. And I think if someone asked me years ago the importance of art, I probably would have said there isn't any. But because I've got background, you know, with science, I always thought, you know, science improves life, that medicine improves life, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, you know, the best way to look at it is, I mean, science and medicine may increase the length of your life, but you know, it's arts that you live for.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, every single person, whether you like it or not, they would appreciate art in some form or another, whether it be music, film, TV, computer games, or you know, paintings. Who knows? But and it's something that does need to be appreciated, because if that's what people are, you know, that's what people want to enjoy, then it should be invested.
And I think art therapy is a massive thing, and people don't really know much about it.
No.
The only reason I know about it is because my wife, she's a musical theatre director
and
an acting coach, so she rolls with that, and she 100% believes in art therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before I met her, I was just like, oh, musical theatre, it's not for blokes, that. Whereas now, I love the theatre, and I go as much as I can.
Yeah. Well, same with me, like fashion. I mean, I caught the fashion bug because my wife doing that at university, and then knowing Emma. Now that's a big thing for me. It never used to be a thing. I never used to think about fashion as something of importance. I used to just be, if it's cheap and comfortable, that's what I'm wearing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's important.
Definitely.
But, I mean, as I previously mentioned, I mean, about me being at Barclays, so... As I was saying, so at Headley Court, a lot of the focus is on prosthetics. And for the guys, they try and focus on what they've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for most people, they focus on what they lost as if in physical. They've lost their limbs, they want prosthetics.
Yeah.
I can't really do that because the extent of my injuries, I'd need more surgery to do that. And I realised I spent years and years trying to get prosthetics. And it's just not working for me. So why waste my time doing that? And there's a lot more things I've lost here that I've not even thought about. Essentially, I've lost my job. I'm going to get medically discharged. I know that.
Yeah.
So I need to find another job. I mean, my confidence is terrible. I'd lost that. So all these things that I'd lost, I was trying to recover. So when I was at Headley Court, keep going back, and it's like you spend all day in the gym, and what's the point? I can't do prosthetics.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no point me really being here. You won't discharge me yet because I still need more surgery, and you need me to have this surgery before I discharge, and it's fair enough. That's your obligation. So I started looking at other things. I started looking at going to the education centre, working on the computers and doing various courses. And my recovery officer, Kev, he finally convinced me to go on a core recovery event. So these... And don't get medically discharged from Headley Court or anything like that. They'd go to one of the recovery centres across the country and do these core recovery events. And the one I went on, it was a week. And there was a later one that was 2 weeks. And they would just basically look at the basic stuff, the kind of stuff that... So the career transition partnership, there's a lot of challenges with trying to find a job anyway.
Yep.
But coming with injuries as well, it becomes so much more difficult. So they have these special courses. And in that, you'll get presentations from numerous people that have started businesses or gone to work for big companies. And it's good getting that. And then you do these aptitude tests. And I did that. And I did quite well, actually. So I think there's six separate tests. And I was either top 1 or top 10% on all of those. So they said, well, you're not stupid. So you might want to think about this. And I really wasn't keen on it. And because obviously I've only got one hand. I'm a big gamer.
Yeah.
Playing computer games is difficult. So yeah, sure. I designed an Xbox controller that allowed me to play. And my recovery officer, Kev, he was connected to some of the guys that work at Barclays. And they basically said that there's an opportunity coming up in the accessible technology team. So I'll be making products for customers with disabilities within Barclays. Are you interested? And it was like, I don't really know. And it was a case of, but, you know, we'll cover your accommodation and you'll get paid more for the inconvenience of living in a flat in London. And I was like, great, because you're not in military accommodation.
That sounds good.
I was like, okay. And I wasn't really sold on it, and I probably shouldn't admit to this. The main reason I went for it is because my wife had just got a work placement at Zoe Jordan, so a fashion designer in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh God, that's a 3-month summer like work placement, like an internship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, I can't afford her accommodation, because we lived up in Norwich at the time. So it was a case of, I can't afford it. And Kev, my recovery officer, on the slide, it was like, you do know she could just live there with you, right?
Mm.
I won't tell anyone. It's not against the rules. So I actually got myself on this work placement, this internship, to provide for my wife because I couldn't afford to pay for her accommodation. And it started as I'm just doing it for this purpose. And then the longer I was at Barclays, the more I enjoyed it. So as I went through various phases, I worked in, you know, sanctions and financial crime. I've been project managers for numerous bits. Now, the day before, I actually just passed like a project management course. Now, like I said, anyone in the military can be a project manager.
Sure.
It's it's a course on common sense, basically. And the day before, I only just passed the course, and I found myself the next day in charge of an £18 million conduct risk project, taken over from a project manager with 10 years experience and had previously done law at university, so I understand all the legal jargon. Mm. I've taken over something I didn't really understand, and I wasn't a permanent thing on that thing. I was there for 2 months just to keep it afloat until they could find someone, you know, with more experience to do that. And it didn't crash and burn. I kept it afloat. There was a few issues with reports being submitted that were wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not a lawyer.
No.
It's my job to actually put all the reports in the correct place and manage bits and pieces and make sure people are in the right place. I don't understand the legal jargon, sure. But I kept it afloat and did that. So that was pretty cool. And you know, the budgets I was dealing with was insane. It was like, that's more money than I'll make in my lifetime right there. So I did that. And then off the back of that, I've then been involved with Emma's charity. And I gave a speech at the Brits. And yep. Emma thought, you know, that was a good speech. So do you have your paper copy? I don't ever write speeches. I just talk and never shut up. So I typed this thing up and I started. And I must have been typing for about 12 hours straight. I don't know how, but both Prince William and Kate saw that. So I got a really nice letter from them saying that it was actually a you know, pretty powerful piece of writing, because it covers like everything, you know, the physical and the mental aspects and you know, all the mental issues that I've been dealing with and stuff like that. So it covers all of that. And Emma found out that, so at the time chairman of Barclays, he was a big fan of classical music. And this thing at the Ritz, so it was the music department from Eton. Mm-hmm. So they found out about the charity, you know, because Emma's well connected, and they decided, you know, we're going to put on this thing at the Ritz. So the Ritz provided the room for free, and all these amazing young musicians turned up and started playing. Like, these people now go on to like be in massive orchestras. Like, these guys are incredible. And Emma sold tickets to raise money for the charity, but at the same time, it's awareness. And that was the first time I did a public speech. And yeah, I got a few jokes in there. You know, I always start with a joke. They were really tame, honestly. The stuff I say now, I'm not sure. Not many people could tell a dick joke in front of Prince Charles and get away with it. and he laughed as well. So that was a real positive that he actually laughed at that as well, which is brilliant. So this speech, I typed it up, and it's over like probably about 10, 15 pages or so. And it basically is, you know, a lot of stuff we covered here plus more. You know, it got ended up in front of, you know, Will and Kate. They read it. I got a letter from them saying that was brilliant. Wow. So I've got that at home still, which is really cool. And then she sent it to, at the time, chairman of Barclays. And obviously I mentioned what I'd done at Barclays and how I've enjoyed it there.
Yeah.
And how, you know, I've understood now that, you know, I may not have had rank or really any qualifications, but really it's the transferable skills. Now, I mean, I preach that a lot to a lot of people, whether it be, you know, veterans or even to people finishing university. Mm-hmm. Like, I've just spoke to random people online saying that they're struggling to get employment. And I looked at their CVs and they're terrible, because they're focusing on like, oh, I have a qualification. But ultimately it's the underlying skills what sells that. Yeah. And I mean, essentially a qualification is third party validation. You have a skill. That's all it is. So
it's everything that goes behind it.
Yeah, exactly. So if you could sell that your skill in that way, I mean, I got my job solely based on skills. I don't really have many relevant qualifications for it. So this letter got sent to, at the time, chairman. And he basically said, I want to meet this person. And obviously, you know, it was just a general chit-chat, but one of the first things he said was, so I know you've been here for a while, and I spoke to, you know, Stuart, the guy who created, you know, the AFTER program that, you know, he supported you.
Yeah.
And he says that you've not applied for any jobs yet. So what's holding you back? Why are you not applying for anything? And it was like, well, I mean, to be fair, I was getting my flat ready to rent out in Norwich. So I was moving down from London anyway, and I had a tent. I was getting it ready, getting renovated. So I was busy focusing on that. And I said, obviously, I'd love to, but I've been focusing on personal issues. I'm still in the process of getting medically discharged. And he basically said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm not entirely sure. Just I'd like to speak to Stuart again about that, because obviously, you know, that program supported me to where I was. And then I decided, well, actually, I want to work in the program. They've helped me a lot. I've learned a lot through that, and I think I can give a lot back there. Yeah. So spoke to Stuart, made a few things happen. A few meetings later, they said, we're trying to create a new job within the team, because at the time there's only one permanent employee in the team. So create another job in the team, and
amazing.
And I basically got the job. I mean, I was preferred candidate because I'd worked there before. I knew people.
Yeah.
I know how the whole system works and everything. So, I got the job, and now I help run our events. So essentially, what our program does, people like myself, not just injured, but not just junior ranks. We've supported anyone from, you know, generals to private soldiers, you know, that come for us for CV advice, because CVs in the military, as you know, we don't do CVs.
Yeah.
We never interview for a job. You're just told you're promoted, you know, and when you're putting a new job, it's like you're expected to be the subject matter expert within, what, a week? Do you ever get a handover? Nope. You're just told, there you go, figure it out.
Yeah.
So all of these skills, you know, they don't do that in this filling world. So it's trying to get people to understand the skills they've got. Now, obviously, my background in bomb disposal, obviously, there's technical aptitude and risk. You know, I've got examples of, you know, like accommodation I got, which essentially I took the whole risk on for everyone there to get a job done.
Yeah.
It went fine. You know, so, you know, that's the very basics of it. You know, there's a chap in my team, he's a parachute regiment sniper. I mean, you ask most civilians, what can he do? Well, he can poke holes in people at a long distance, but they don't understand. Obviously, there's a communication. There's patience for one, which that is actually a brilliant skill to have, and it's noticing small details changed. So it's attention to detail. All these things that, you know, so I never say it to his face. I never be positive about him. God knows. but all those skills that are there that a civilian may not understand. So my program, we work in two main areas. We're trying to help veterans and even reserves understand that your service has provided the following skills. Here's how you can sell them.
Yes.
And here's why they're relevant. Because they're not told that.
No.
They're not told that when they're in service.
That's massively lacking.
I've met colonels, you know, senior officers who are leaving, and they are just like, I don't know how to get a job.
Yeah.
And I tell them about transferable skills, and they look at me like, well, what do you mean?
Yeah.
I've given presentations to university officer training corps at university. They've not even joined the military yet. And I tell them about how important these skills are, the skills that you can learn. They just don't know it. I mean, they're not told. And that's where, you know, the transition process, it kind of gets really, you know, it's a bit of a quagmire, really. People just get stuck with, you know, your infantry security, you're an engineer, construction, logistics, driver. They're typecast roles, and actually, generally speaking, they're generally beneath people's ability because they look at it as you had a manual labour job. Yeah, in military may be manual, but it's more than that. There's management of people, leadership.
And, is that all the little building blocks that create that?
Yeah,
that skill set.
I mean, you know, a good example about leadership. I mean, whether, you know, in financial services, you don't get leadership training through your managing director.
No.
Now, to get to a managing director, generally speaking, you'd have to have 20 to 25 years experience in financial services to be a managing director.
Exactly.
It takes that long to get leadership training. Even as a private soldier, by the time you come out of training, you've had some kind of leadership training. You've been under the influence of strong leaders. They're starting to groom you for leadership positions.
Or you've been appointed command.
You're in charge of this section for this attack. You're in charge, you know. So you've had some leadership training. It would not be as relevant, but the fact of the matter is you had some experience. I mean, like I said, I was a private, you know, I was private equipment. Now, you know, I'm an assistant vice president. Now, that sounds very impressive, but realistically, what that means is that's a graduate plus 4 years experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of just circumvented, I don't have a degree, I don't have A-levels,
yeah.
And I didn't have four years experience. And I went straight into that because it's transferable skills. Now, I understand, you know, the military mindset and I understand, you know, the people. And so that's what we do on the veteran side. So we help with CVs. We have these big events to try and help change people's perceptions because that's the biggest issue with perception.
How do people go about finding this help or advice, if anything?
I mean, we have numerous websites. I mean, really, you can just look for Barclays After. So if any companies want to hire veterans, they come and speak to us. They get to use our website, which we provide for free. And there's all of these services we provide. And all they really do is get access to thousands of people looking for jobs. So that's what we do with the company side. It's advising people in companies why hiring veterans is a positive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not charity. It's someone that's going to benefit your company. And it's brilliant. We used one of our colleagues as an example, who was a non-graduate officer, so no, didn't have a degree.
Yeah.
And he actually went to work for the at the time CEO. So his first job there was as vice president. Then off the back of that, he made director. Mm-hmm. So he was a director in financial services with just 4 years experience in the bank. And he was 30 and non-grad. So we used him as an example because ultimately a lot of people in that room were saying that. It's like, but he's non-grad. You know, there's the skill set that you don't understand that they can bring to this. And he's an officer, but he's non-graduate. So the bank has become a lot more lapsed. And since then, they've created numerous apprenticeships. So there's a higher and a lower apprenticeship. The lower apprenticeship, you straight from school. And by the end of it, you'll be working at the same level as someone that's gone through college and university and you're the same age. So basically, that's what we do. We educate people on why they should hire veterans because there's a massive skill set for people that are massively underemployed. We'd previously got someone who used to be responsible for billions of pounds worth of Eurofighters as like the head engineer for a whole squadron of Eurofighters. And after service, ended up working in McDonald's. Not even running a McDonald's, he was mopping the floor.
Wow.
And it was like, you are really selling yourself short here. Yeah, you're responsible 100%. For billions of pounds worth of equipment, and now you're mopping the floor of a grotty McDonald's. So it's trying to get people to understand they can do more. You know, they're just mis-selling themselves, getting employers to understand they can do more, and facilitating work placements to, you know, because, you know, they say a pitch paints 1,000 words. You can introduce them to people that have been there and done that. It helps change those perceptions. Yeah. And I'd say it improves a lot of
confidence as well.
Exactly.
You lose your confidence when you leave the military. I've spoken to so many people because you're in your environment, you're secure in your environment in the military. You know your job, you do it, you know everyone knows you know.
Yep.
And that's it. You leave, and it's a whole new world.
Well, yeah, because you've gone from, because like the military is not just a career, it's a lifestyle. There's not many jobs out there where it's a lifestyle. I mean, you can look at, I guess, your sports stars and people like that, because it's a lifestyle, not just a job, and it is like that. So, you know, it's what you know. I mean, you go to any professional footballer, they get injured, their job's over because, okay, what career experience do you have? I kick a ball. What's this? You know, they don't have those kind of skills that people can really relate to. So it's like that. But the military, they kind of hide those transferable skills. And it's one of those things, look, people get it, they get it. And obviously we've got a big program at Barclays. We've hired, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people, and through our partner, you know, company Vets, we've hired thousands.
Yeah.
And the good thing is, obviously, that message, every person we hire, that's getting that message out there that, you know, they should hire people. And actually, as a result, people, even directors at Barclays, have later joined the reserve. Brilliant. So people have looked at this and been like, well, actually, I've seen what you've brought from service, and I've concentrated my whole life on my career, and honestly, I'm just getting bored being in an office. I want something different.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say names, but, you know, this chap then joined, you know, the Royal Navy as a reserve officer, and he, you know, and it's actually helped his career since. He has been promoted since as well. So, you know, it's getting out there that service does bring more than just the negatives.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. I mean, I really appreciate you coming and telling your story. And it's great to see you.
Yeah,
you know, pushing forward and
I appreciate that. You know,
yeah, you're doing brilliantly.
Onwards and upwards.
That's 100%. And hopefully, you know, you can, with what you're doing, will help more people.
Well, that's why I do what I do. I mean, I love doing what I do. It is kind of, you know, it is one of my passions. And even when I'm not actually at work, there's people I'm talking to online that I've never met.
Yeah.
That I'm actually advising on these things. I'm not actually doing it in a work capacity, but people's CVs are terrible, and what they're saying is just wrong, and they don't understand how recruitment works. So.
Well, hopefully, you know, this platform can push that through as well, and we can help.
Well, I hope so. I mean, if it's just getting the message out there and getting people to understand their skill sets. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying come work for Barclays, but, you know, there will be jobs going. And, but at the same time, it does not matter if you want to come work for Barclays or not. If you want help with, you know, CVs, interviews, and, you know, basically how to try and assimilate in, you know, the civilian population, you know, we all have experience doing that. I mean, most of our programs are military or have been around us long enough that they fully understand it. So. Yeah. Check it out. Like I said, you know, it costs nothing. It doesn't, you know, you can do it while you're in service. And, you know, the events I run are, they're pretty good, actually. We do two of those a year in three different locations, and it takes months to plan, but it's good fun.
Yeah, man.
And you want to cut this bit out, but we go to the pub after and we do get a little pissed.
Well, that's what it's all about. We'll cut that out. We'll leave it in. Yeah. Dude, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right, welcome.